Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, so much younger than today.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you're with us tonight, Bill Arnold on the side of the studio and across the way, George P. Fraser, two guys who are hopefully an enjoyable speed bump on the information highway. Hi, George.
Hey, Billy. How are you?
I'm good. So nice to see you again once in studio. I know you had a little bit of medical procedures last week, so it's great to see you moving around.
That's kind of how I'm doing.
I've been talking since
Uncle Joey's a moving slow, right?
Yeah, at the junction.
Makes
me want to snap your suspenders if you had some on.
No, I don't. I'm real excited to be in the studio tonight because of our guest, John.
We'll bring him on later, time permitting.
Well, he's been on before, and it's a great story. So if you're tuning in, stay with us. This is going to be one of our best shows. Of course, they're all really good.
They're award-winning, George. There, I said it.
It's kind of tough to keep doing it every week, but God helps us.
He does. Let me start with a passage from Isaiah, chapter 55, verse 6. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. You know, if you are listening to the show, it's maybe because God has led you to the program. If you're struggling with an addiction or you're a place where you don't know where you're going to turn or what you're going to do next, trust me, God's knocking on your door tonight.
That's right. There's no coincidences here. And what we want to look at is God nudging me here? Why do I have an interest in this? Why am
exactly.
I thinking about changing something? Could be the Holy Spirit,
yeah.
And you want to act on that for good and do it quickly.
Because you're entirely incapable of doing it yourself.
Well, and you don't want to.
And you don't want to.
That's part of the deal. Why would I want to quit drinking when I have so much fun going to jail? You know, the hospital and everybody's mad at me.
Yeah. You've alienated and chased everyone out of your life who ever loved you.
Well, I've managed to do that in sobriety, but let's move on here. Yeah, you know, and I think what happens is we feel like we have this. And so we got to keep doing it. And God nudges you. It's like, hey, maybe I should look at this. And tonight we're going to hear a story about somebody who had long-term recovery, who went back.
Spoiler alert.
And, well, the rest of the story is too good.
Yeah.
And I like that. When God is near, I think, Bill, and I can't back this scripturally just from working with people for over 20 years, we have windows of opportunity. And a lot of people who relapse, and a lot of them we've gone to their funerals, think that I can do this one more time, and if it doesn't work out, I'll get back in the program.
Mm-hmm.
You got to survive the relapse, and there's no guarantee on that, and a lot of people don't. Satan roars around like a lion looking for somebody to devour, and this is no game. We are looking at powers and principalities that are talked about in Ephesians that are dark and more powerful than we are, and we need to go to God to help us want to change it and to change it.
Mm-hmm. And George, you know, on Real Recovery, we always try to do a step or two. Sometimes we do two steps, given the nature of our guest tonight and his diverse story and background. We may try to quickly cover two steps tonight.
Well, I think given the nature of our guest tonight, we should do all 12 of them, but that's just me. And I think on a serious note, what we really look at is, this is not a linear progression where I do one, two, three, four. It's circular.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way we walk out our salvation with fear and trembling. And tonight's story for me, I got to see it up close, is the power of God to take someone who is dead and bring them back alive,
mm-hmm.
just like he did in a lot of our lives. John's story is really powerful, but tonight we're going to look at two steps.
Okay.
And they're 8 and 9. On 8, we make a list of all people we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And on step 9, we make direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And we've talked before, you've brought it up, it's such a good point. The clause of, well, I don't want to do this because it would injure others, maybe 0.0001%. That would qualify for.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to make an amend to God, too,
mm-hmm. so
for our life, a living amend.
Yeah. When you made a list of all the people you had to make amends to, was it the size of the Manhattan phone book?
it was lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, and this is kind of selfish, that I wanted to make an amend to myself, too.
Interesting. Say more about that.
As a child of God, an heir to the throne, because I got saved before I got sober, that I wanted to stop putting myself through this.
Mm-hmm.
And people can disagree with that, and I'm open to being wrong. Gosh, I'm open to that because I'm wrong every day. But I think as a child of the king, I'm not supposed to be eating out of garbage cans and breaking the law and running and gunning and using people instead of using things and loving things instead of loving people. And that's what we do when we're out there. And there's no rules. You know, the off button's broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to make an amend to people we have harmed. Try to take care of our side of the street. Now, we got forgiveness in step five, and that can only come from Jesus. So we're walking in as a child of God who is forgiven. What can I do to make this right? And God will show you. And most of the time, the grace of God, people don't slam you. They're really glad to help you. But you might get somebody who says, no, I don't want to have anything to do with you. Well, you know what? You did your part.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to make a living amend, because if I truly gave my life to Jesus, and we talk about in step three where we make a decision to turn our will and our life with the care of God as we understand him, we're living for him now and not ourselves.
Mm-hmm. George, I know I revisit this idea every once in a while when we talk about an amend, because is that language that other people understand? Or do you call someone and say, can I meet with you so I can tell you how sorry I am?
Well, I think there's more than that.
I know it's
that.
Kind of the same thing, but
there's more than that. What can I do to make it right? Hey, Bill, you know, you loaned me $5,000 a couple years ago, and I'm really sorry I blew it on booze and drinking. So I'm sorry about it.
Well, why don't you do something about it, you lowlife?
I am sorry about it. It's Mr. Lowlife to you, Phil.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll call you Dr. Lowlife if you want.
Well, I love that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the only time you'd be called doctor, by the way.
It's a lifestyle choice on my part, one I've tried to be consistent with. But you've got to try to do your part. Sorry is not enough. And I remember when my dad said to me, a real man, if he's truly sorry, he doesn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that what repent means? It's a navigational term that says turn and go the other direction.
I like the navigational term, Captain.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Skipper hat.
Anyway. Yeah, this is good. Yeah. When you do the morning show, your sleep deprivation catches up on Sunday night. And
it
I
does,
can see
it?
That tonight.
Yeah, I'm a little punchy now.
Yeah, I'm going to have some fun with you tonight, and then I'll probably get closed out. But you're exactly right. I'm going to do about face. I think the thing is we need to be willing to swallow our pride and go, what would God have me do here?
Mm-hmm. Pride is the worst of all, isn't it?
It is, and it's both ends. You know, the shame thing a lot of times is just pride.
Mm-hmm.
I feel too ashamed and to do it. Well, we're all broken and fall short of the glory
of
God.
And I would say the enemy wants us to live in constant shame. If he keeps us there, he has us where he wants us.
Yes. Guilt good, shame bad.
Mm-hmm. And in order to start a life of transformation, at a certain point, God has to deal with that shame and put an end to it and give you a place where you can deal with it and move on. Otherwise, you won't be transformed.
Absolutely. And being full of shame apart from God is normal.
Mm-hmm.
I get my worth from Christ. Apart from me, you can do nothing.
Yeah. But if you have shame, it will continue to perpetuate, I believe, because you feel shame, you feel guilty, you feel bad. You go out and do it again because why not?
Sure. Shame is feeling bad about who we are. Guilt for me is feeling bad about what I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, George, I know we've got a great in-studio guest tonight, John. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. But,
do we have time for John?
I don't know. We're okay. On a little bit of a roll.
John's taking notes. This could be deadly.
I know, but we're on kind of a hot roll right now, George.
We are.
I'm not so sure when we come back from break that John will need him as a guest.
I think we're kind of running out here, so
yeah.
Let's get to it.
All right, we'll take a short break, and when we come back, our in-studio guest, John, is with us tonight. We're so glad you joined us tonight on Real Recovery. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. So glad you're with us tonight. We're talking about Isaiah 55. We started talking about seek the Lord while he may be found, call on him while he is near. So thanks for listening tonight, and we believe that he is near if you're listening. So do pay attention. to what God might be trying to say to you tonight. And here in studio is our guest, John. George, why don't you take the lead and bring him onto the show?
Yeah, okay, at Parenthood, we play that song for a lot of our guests, so that just wasn't customized for you. This is one of my favorite people that I've met.
Dial it back just a little.
In recovery, and a good friend of mine. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, George. Good to be here.
He's done the show before, and we've had a lot of updates the last couple years, but I'd like you to take us back from the beginning when you were growing up, what kind of family you grew up in, and your first use.
Sure, yeah. I'm actually from Louisiana. I've been here in Minnesota since 2000. I came up here to get sober myself, to go to treatment. But I grew up in, I went to private schools in Louisiana in Baton Rouge. My father was a real estate developer, home builder. We didn't really want for anything. When I was a boy, we moved around a lot because, you know, my dad was a home builder and that was kind of just the nature of things. But at some point, he went through a bankruptcy. And the Lord kind of used that experience to rescue him. He ended up getting involved with, I think it was a Maranatha church down in Baton Rouge, and helped build them a building on the LSU campus, and got saved, you know, through that. And he started bringing me to church, and that's where I first heard the gospel. And I just remember singing songs and just being overcome with joy, you know, at what the Lord had done for us. And so I got saved as a young boy.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, gosh, man. I was probably in third grade or something. I was young, and I remember going to school and telling all the kids at school about what the Lord had done for me. And and I was kind of walking out repentance, and I was sharing this truth, this reality with the kids at school. And I was, you know, and I was kind of a bad kid. I got in a lot of trouble and, you know, I would cuss and do things. I remember telling all the kids, hey, we can't talk like that and we need to change. And, my mother did not like me going to church with my dad. She was Episcopalian. She wanted us to go to church there. And you know what they say about Episcopalians? Wherever you find four of them together, you'll find a fifth. Well, anyway, that was part of our experience.
A lot of them don't listen to our show. We can edit that. We don't have to put that in there.
In Louisiana, there was a lot of drinking culturally. Okay. It was a big part of the culture down there. Whenever something was going on, there was booze involved. When I was about eight, I think, or nine, I stole some booze from my mom and snuck out and drank it and got sick. And, you know, most people, normal people, which, by the way, I don't really know what that is, nor do I even really want to be around normal people. But normal people, when they drink and get sick, they don't want more, right? And I, for some reason, wanted more.
So it started early.
Started early, yeah. 9 years old, started stealing booze from my parents and drinking. And 10, 11, smoking pot. Dealing it at school, right? Seventh grade, I got kicked out of school. I got kicked out of this private school because they said I was a bad influence. At 12, I remember this, at 11, maybe 11 or 12 years old, a doctor prescribed me some opioids for an earache, and it was a liquid form, and I remember taking a tablespoon instead of a teaspoon, and love the way it made me feel.
And okay, hold the bus here. This has gotten away from let's not talk that way because of Jesus to your dealing, and you're
that's
a full
right.
skill addict here.
That's
aren't you?
Right. That's right. I turned my back on the Lord because of family dynamics. That seed was never nurtured, and I was. And it was like the parable of the sower, where the seed's sown on rocky ground and it falls away. And that was me. But back in the back of my mind, I knew the Lord was real, and I knew he was calling me to live for him, and I was unwilling to do it. And that produces a lot of shame and guilt. You get back to the shame you were talking about earlier. When you know God is real and you know he's calling you, which he is, by the way, He wants you to live for him. And anything short of that, we're not going to be satisfied. And we're going to feel shame. And that was me. And I wanted to run from that reality. And the drugs gave me a way to hide from that reality.
Was that strong enough to get you to stop?
No. No, in fact, this dynamic went on for many, many years.
Were you still going to church and stuff? Were you a double-minded man?
No, I wasn't. I was just full-on in rebellion, running from God.
So you get kicked out of the school. I imagine you got into another one.
Yeah, I got into another one. You know, the kids didn't know me there. I got elected president of the student body, and I had all the kids go home and raid their parents' medicine cabinets and bring me all the drugs, and I sold them. And eventually got caught and got suspended, and it was, it was not a good deal. You know, it made the paper and everything. It was kind of a big deal. And, but that was traumatic for a kid in eighth grade for that to happen to, you know, that's trauma, you know, and that gives you more shame, right? And it feeds the shame. And we know what to do with that, right? Just use some more, right? So it exacerbated my addiction. These, you know, circumstances in my life. Ninth grade, you know, I didn't do well in school. My parents sent me off to boarding school, got kicked out of there.
There's a pattern here.
Yeah, there's a pattern. Came home. I remember this man showed up at my house with a 12-pack of beer and said, "Hey, I'm Dr. Such and Such. Your mom just sold me a house. I'm starting this new school. I'd love for you to come to my school." And I'm like, "Sure." So he had gone around and recruited all these kids that had been kicked out of other schools. And so there were a lot of bad kids at this school. And I fell in with a really, really tough crowd and got into some bad stuff. I remember one time a lot of guys were stealing, and me and this guy stole a car and wrecked it and got arrested. But I always had a healthy fear of jail. And when that happened, I said, I'm not doing this kind of life anymore. I'm not going to steal anymore because I don't want to go to prison, right? And so I stopped stealing at that point. But I was still heavily into drugs. And by this time, I'm, you know, 17, 18, and I'm doing pills, lots of pills. And my grades are terrible. I go off to school. I fail out of college.
Boy, who saw that coming?
Right?
Oh, yeah.
I eventually got myself into another school, pulled up my grades. It was a nightmare, though. My entire educational experience was traumatic, you know.
Sounds like your life was traumatic, huh, Bill?
It does. I mean, the story is being so beautifully told by John, and yet in eighth grade, he is convincing his classmates, who, by the way, just voted him in to be class president, to raid their parents' medicine cabinets for pills.
Absolutely brilliant on your part, John. Congratulations.
Yeah, so
keep it going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this went on for 24 years or so, and raiding medicine cabinets was a thing that I did a lot. And, you know, for any of you listening out there, if you do have drugs in your house, you should make sure they're locked up, because addicts will find them if they come into your house. They will find them.
That's a good point.
And you never know if your kids have friends come over. The friends can use the bathroom and raid unbeknownst to the friend, right?
That's right.
I mean, it doesn't take much. Kids will go looking for stuff.
That's right.
And other adults will as well.
And that was the source of a lot of the drugs that I did growing up. And you know, that was a problem for me.
Any legals? Did you have some legal problems?
Yeah, I got arrested a lot. But I never had anything that really stuck. I had some enabling forces in my life. I had a godfather that was an attorney, and he thought it was fun to get me out of trouble. And, you know, I got arrested a number of times, probably a couple of dozen, and nothing ever really stuck. I got to a point where, I wound up in jail. And I called all my family and friends, and I had a $150 bail, and they said, "You're right where you need to be." And I was, you know, by this time, I'd progressed so far in my addiction that I ended up on a methadone clinic, right? And I was literally enslaved to going to this window and getting a drug every day, and I couldn't function without it. And it was a nightmare.
How long did that go on?
That went on for 4 years.
Oh, my goodness. That's unbelievable,
and,
John.
Yeah, yeah. And I was enslaved to this stuff. And but I wound up in jail, and I had a $150 bail. It was some, you know, traffic thing. And I called all my family and friends, and they said, "You're right where you need to be." And that was a moment of clarity for me. That was tough. I made a decision right then and there that I was going to get sober, right? I was going to do whatever it took to get sober. Now, it took me a couple of years from that point to actually get there. There was a lot of trial and error there. But I remember leaving the jail, walking to the Salvation Army, staying there, and I called my dad, and I remember standing on the corner on this payphone in the rain, and I said, "Dad, I really want to get sober. I want to turn my life around. I'm serious this time." And he says, "Son," he says, "your mother has been so worried about you that she's neglecting me, and I have this infection in my nose that's been misdiagnosed for the last year, and I just found out it's cancer." And he said, "Son, you are killing me." And for the first time in my life, I realized that my behavior was affecting other people. I was 31 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
That feel like somebody shot you?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I just another moment of clarity.
So did you stay at the Army?
I didn't stay there long. I couldn't.
So
really
you got over it,
there.
Pretty quick, yeah. But it shocked you.
Well, yeah. I eventually wound up in a detox, went to treatment, a state-run facility, because I'd been kicked out of all the private places, and my family wasn't going to pay for it anymore. And because I completed a program, they shipped me to a halfway house in Phoenix, where I stayed for, you know, 4 or 5 months.
I like this. They got him out of state. Now, I know we're going to go to a break here, Bill, but one of the things that I really want everybody to stop and look at is how powerful addiction is. John is not a bad guy. He became a Christian when he was young. He hears that from his dad. Totally knocks him over. And for a while it works, but then he's back in detox. And so if you have somebody in your life, some grace and mercy, I want to have good boundaries, but it's really powerful.
Yeah. We'll take a short break when we come back. More with John in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill George, be back in a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. So glad you're with us tonight. Bill and George, we are in studio with John. What a story. George, I'm riveted.
Well, keep with it. I know the rest of it. It's great. If you're listening tonight, you're going to hear a story of a guy that got totally transformed and took a dead person, made him alive, and helped him to share that with others.
Okay,
kind of want to get back to it.
Yeah, why are you talking and not him?
I got you. I agree with you for once.
He can't help it.
Yeah, I can't.
So, yeah, so George, I'm in Arizona. I'm having limited success because I'm putting out limited effort. I'm, half measures. I'm trying to do it my way, still trying to do it my way. And if you guys have worked with a lot of alcoholics, you know how hard-headed we can be. We like to do things our way, and so that's what I was trying to do even in my recovery. I wanted to take the directions that I wanted to hear, and that was it. So I had limited success, but I did have some success. And at one point when I was in Arizona, I had disappeared. I was off the radar. I was using heroin. My mother was super worried about me, and she hadn't heard from me in, you know, a month. And she had a strep infection that, because she was so, you know, sick with worry, she didn't follow through on the protocol with the medication she was supposed to take or whatever. And she developed these rare Onca antibodies in her blood that caused her immune system to attack her kidneys. And they shut down. Now it took some time. And during this process, I come up to Minnesota, go to treatment, move into a halfway house, live in a sober house, and I'm, you know, I'm active in the recovery community in St. Paul. Eventually, her kidneys shut completely down, and I was able to give her one of mine. So we went out to Johns Hopkins, and I gave her a kidney, and here we are. Gosh, it's been 15, 16 years later, and she's just doing great with it. So my illness played a role in her physical health, but what a great amends I was able to make in giving her one of my kidneys, you know.
I don't know what to say.
No, that is cool.
It was
a joy, and I was glad to do it, you know. And she's doing great. Both my parents are still alive. They're down in Louisiana. In fact, she's coming up here in 2 weeks. I'm still running from the Lord, though, George. Right?
You're sober.
I'm sober. And I thought that if I could just get sober, get a life, and really the reason I got sober was because my desire for a life outweighed my desire to get high. You know, that's kind of how it worked out. And I thought if I could just get sober, get a career, get a wife, have a family, own my own home, that I would be content and I would be happy and I would be satisfied. And the Lord blessed me with all of that in spite of the fact that I'm running from him, that I was a rebel to his will, and he blessed me with all that anyway. And you know what? I was not satisfied.
Can I ask you a question about that, John? And the way, my guess is that you were maintaining your abstinence was a lot of it through the 12-step movement.
Yep.
And probably pretty active and liking it. Would it be fair to say for somebody who might be listening tonight that that might seem enough, but without the Lord, it's just not enough?
Well, I would say that, you know, the 12 steps and community, the power of community and common struggle and all that is a great way to get sober, right? That really helped me get sober. But sobriety is just that, right? That doesn't satisfy us, right? Like, because we were built, we were designed, we were created for a relationship with our Creator, and there's only one way to have that, and that's through His Son. Right? Sobriety doesn't give us that. And there is a novel quality to sobriety. When you first get sober, you hear people talk about this pink cloud. That's real. You know, it's awesome, you know, to be sober and to be able to do life and be trustworthy and learn how to be a friend and all these things. They're really good things, right? But ultimately, they don't satisfy us. They leave us wanting more. And so I was using the 12 steps, the power of community, right, which is a higher power in our life. I was using that and also service work. I was doing a lot of service. I was working with a lot of guys, and I was carrying the message out there. That's what kept me sober for a long time.
You got into the business, too, didn't you?
I did. Yep. I was working for an organization here in town that's kind of a 12-step immersion program, and we drew people from all over the country. And I was the marketing director for them, and I helped grow that organization quite a bit, and I developed a lot of relationships around the country. And so my career and my vocation and my I had a lot wrapped up in my recovery. You know, that was a big part of my identity.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I want to say here, being in that business myself, you started with a treatment center mm-hmm. that became one of the major players in the country. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the reason, Bill, is because of John's work, along with John Curtis and some others. Mm-hmm. And they were flying in first class, leading the way. And mm-hmm. it was other people wanted to copy it and started in other places. And they were really on the forefront mm-hmm. of the low-cost producer with the best results.
Yeah.
But that wasn't good enough.
No, it wasn't good enough because, back to my point, that there's one thing that truly satisfies us, and that's a relationship with God, right? And I didn't have that. I was running from him. And deep down, I knew he was there and he was calling me. And I had that guilt and shame, right? And I didn't know what to do with it, you know? And by now, I've got a career. I've got a beautiful wife, a beautiful young boy that's 3 months old. And I had surgery on my foot, right? And I was an opiate addict. Had surgery on my foot, and I went off the deep end on the pain meds. And eventually started doing coke and everything else. And it
How quickly did that happen?
It happened over a few months.
So were you still working at the treatment center?
Yep, I was.
So you got a secret here.
I got a secret here. And eventually it's not a secret. The jig is up when my wife catches me. She turns to all my friends. Now my friends, mind you, they work in the business. So she calls a buddy of mine that's an interventionist, another buddy that runs a bunch of sober living homes. And they come to me and I tell them to, you know, stick it, right? And so she calls my boss, right? And
that's not fair.
And he comes over and he runs a treatment center. And so I couldn't tell him to stick it. I guess I could have, you know, so he took me to detox, and the detox was full. So I told him I was suicidal. I told him I wanted to kill myself. So they put me in the psych ward, because they can't turn you away if you tell them that. They put me in the psych ward, and which is not, I don't recommend doing that, because,
Were you suicidal?
I was not suicidal.
Oh, okay.
But it turns out the doctor that I saw, the psychiatrist, was a family friend. He walks in and he's like, "Oh, John." So that was not a pretty picture. But yeah, so I end up going back to treatment, and I wind up back in treatment. And while I'm there, I'm really forced, George, to examine my purpose in life. Why am I here? What am I doing? Because I'm right on the verge of losing everything. My boss said, if you can't get sober, you're done. And my wife said, if you do this again, we're gone. Right? And not to mention, my identity was so wrapped up in my recovery, career, everything there. I wind up in this treatment center, and the guys that my counselor is a friend of mine, like who was a tech, you know, at the halfway house I lived in. Now he's like running the place. And so, you know, these guys are like, "Man, you're just another guy in here." And even my peers in there, they didn't want to hear what I had to say about recovery, because I was in there with them. And it was a very humbling experience. And it can be hard to come back from that, because there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of shame, not to mention your identity being shattered the way it was.
The man that intervened on you, your boss, told me one time that the longer we're sober and we relapse, the less our chances of staying sober are, because and getting back into recovery, because we don't want to humble ourselves. And yet you did that. What I'm interested in here, Bill, is it's not fair when the hound of heaven pursues us like he does. The wife that came into your life that I know you love very much, this is what you're going to do. You go into the psych ward, you lied about it, mm-hmm. and it's a family friend. It's like God's just not letting you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not to mention, I had been going to church some, still wrestling with God, but going to church, and brought my wife, who was not a believer, right? And she got saved through that process. So she gets saved, becomes a believer. I'm back in treatment. And I'm forced, George, out of desperation, right? I'm just desperate. And I'm forced to really focus in on, okay, what is my purpose in life? Why am I here? And deep down, I knew that it was to glorify God and to be with Him forever. And that anything short of that pursuit was going to leave me unsatisfied and wanting, right? And I was going to use again. And so I get out of treatment. I'm back at church. A guy comes to speak there named Ed Welch. And Ed wrote a book. He's a counselor at the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation out in Pennsylvania, CCEF. Ed wrote a book. He's a PhD neuropsychologist and a biblical counselor. He wrote a book called Addictions, A Banquet in the Grave, right? And I went to hear him speak about his book. And he used the term worship disorder to describe addiction. And it was like, bing, a light bulb went off in my head. And I knew that's what's going on in my life. That's the problem I have. I'm cherishing and worshiping the wrong things. And through that, I learned that there's an opportunity to worship in everything we do. And we are always worshiping. And we worship our way into addiction by turning to things like drugs and alcohol. Typically, it's control, comfort, and escape that we get from it. And we turn to these things over and over and over again. And in a cumulative way, over time, we become enslaved to our own desires, right?
Yeah. Does it start with worshiping ourselves instead of God?
Yeah. I mean, we are turning to ourselves and the things. It starts with self-righteousness, right? We're turning to things in the world, like for me, I had a lot of guilt and shame, and I'm turning to something in the world to deal with that instead of turning to God, right? Instead of turning to the counselor, you know, I'm turning to myself. So the way to get out is to worship God in the mundane, in the small things, in the details of life, right? So God cares about these details. He is sovereign. He cares about the details of our lives, and he will meet us in those details. And it may not seem like, these innocuous things in our life are part of the struggle with addiction, but the tiny things where we can honor God in the mundane, they have that same cumulative effect, and over time, we're able to have victory over those big strongholds in our heart. And we call that worshiping our way out of addiction.
Hmm. Award-winning episode. That's all I have to say, George. We'll take a break, and when we come back, more with John, find out what exactly God has him doing nowadays. Take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us tonight. What a riveting story we have, John, in studio. Amazing, George, that he said he needed to go to a psych ward because he was suicidal. Have you ever been to a psych ward? And if not, why not?
I got the moccasins and a belt. I was there for a while. Yeah,
they make you work on arts and crafts, don't they?
Really helped me a lot.
I'd like to see that those moccasins or that belt. I'd buy the belt.
Yeah, we wind up in... But I didn't need to be there. I wouldn't get a person angry that was where I was. I'm sure.
What a riveting story John's sharing with us tonight. And now I'm kind of excited to see what God is doing going forward with the work he's laid on John's heart to do.
What happened?
Yeah, so I began to pursue God, right? And he is faithful, right? And praise God for that, because he pursued me throughout all of my rebellion, right? And so I began to pursue him, and I began to apply the gospel to the details of my life. And he meets us there, right? And you know, like for instance, in the evening when I'm putting my son to bed and I'm tired and my wife just wants me to stay up and have some adult conversation with her because she's been with the kids all day and I'm tired. I've been talking to people all day and I just want to go to sleep, and I'm falling asleep before my son does, laying in bed reading to him. But there's an opportunity there, right? There's an opportunity for me to worship, right? There's an opportunity for me to do the self-sacrificing thing and take action, right? And honor my wife and honor my God, right? And when I do that, it builds on itself, and I draw closer to him. And that is part of the fight of addiction, that right there. It may not seem like it, but it is, right? And this is what gives us joy. You mentioned repentance earlier, Bill. Repentance is the engine for joy in our lives, right? Turning away from self and toward God, that produces joy. And when we worship God in the details of our lives, we experience joy. And so it becomes less about a fight for holiness than it is about an experience of joy, right? So that's what we call worshiping our way out of addiction. And I'm you know, I'm working in the treatment industry. I've got a lot of contacts. I decide that there is a lack of good, solid, gospel-centered resources in the Christian treatment and recovery world. And I said, let's start a program where we teach people how to worship their way out of addiction that is heart-focused and Christ-centered, where we can get at what's going on in people's hearts, you know, get at those operating mechanisms in the heart and teach people how to worship their way out of addiction. So that's what I did. I put a plan together. I raised money and I started a program called Redemption House here in the cities. And that's what we do. We teach guys that struggle with the idolatry of drug and alcohol addiction how to worship their way out of addiction by honoring God in everything they do.
Let's back up here.
Yeah, we need to.
Now, I remember I was working at the Salvation Army, and you called me up, and we've been friends, and we've met in the recovery circles, and you said that you had something you wanted to show me, and you showed me this idea, and I said, you know, it's great, but you had what I thought was the best job in recovery. Now, you had made it that way. Mm. You're nationwide as a marketing director for a really nice program.
Mm-hmm. Nice office, comfortable chair.
Yeah, good money.
Yeah.
You know, out
nice community.
In Wayzata.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
And you,
it was comfortable.
You did it. You
couldn't
took
talk
the risk.
About Jesus there.
I get that, but I'm just really impressed that God laid that on your heart and you followed through. It was a huge risk.
You know, when God puts something on your heart, George, you can't not do it. You have to do it. When you're called to do something, you have to do it, you know?
But, John, you also had mentioned, too, that you said you were going to get together and start this house called Redemption House and that you got some investors and then now it's in operation. That's a little bit like the person saying, yeah, I got it chiseled, and then all of a sudden there was Mount Rushmore.
Well, yeah. Yeah, first of all, it's a nonprofit. So we did it with money that was donated to us for this purpose. But I just laid the vision out on paper, and I went to Ed Welch, I'm a nobody, so he doesn't want to return my call. So I call out there to CCF and I say, I want to hire Ed for an hour of counseling over the phone. And they agreed to set up a counseling session with him, and I sent the business plan to his secretary and had her show it to him, and he read it and he was like, wow, this is great. I want to help. And so now he serves on our advisory board.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, you know, it was one of those things the Lord put it on my heart and I want to teach people how to do, I want to give people the opportunity to have what I have. You know, I want people to have recovery. And a fulfilling relationship with the Lord. And I feel like, you know, a lot of the programs out there, they're limited, because they don't understand, that real satisfaction is gained through Christ.
Okay. Now, we live in a state where there's great treatment centers, Hazelden, The Retreat, many more. What differentiates your curriculum from those treatment centers?
Well, first of all, you know, we have a very defined higher power, right? And that higher power is Christ, right? And we believe there's only one way to have a relationship with God, and that's through His Son, right? Only way to the Father is through me, is what Jesus said, right? So we want to teach people how to have a relationship with Christ. So it is a heart-focused, Christ-centered model. You know, a lot of the programs are disease models. They approach addiction as a disease. We don't necessarily deny that, but we say there's more to it, right? That underneath it all is the heart, right? And so our you know, the negative fruit in our life, the behaviors are driven by the desires, right? And underneath those desires are the affections. And that's what we're trying to get at. We're trying to replace those selfish desires with a new affection for Christ, right? And so the impetus and the motivation for change in our model is not, well, I want to keep the wife happy, I want to stay out of jail, I want to keep my license, I want to stay alive, right? Because those reasons never really stopped a lot of people. I can't tell you how many people I've met that come in from the ICU and they had esophageal bleeding and the doctor said, if you drink again, you're going to die, and they get to feeling better and 3 weeks later they drink again and die, right? Like that happens, right? And so, the motivation for change in our model is a response to God, a loving response to God. You know, we see the beauty of grace. We see that God loved us so much that he was willing to come down here, live the life that we humble himself, right? Become a babe and live a life of sorrow and die the death that we deserved in order to rescue us. And when we see that truth and we begin to experience that truth and apply that truth to our lives, it melts our heart, right? And we develop a reciprocal fellowship of love with God. He loves us first. We love him back. That becomes the motivation for change, not I got to stay out of jail or I need a better life.
Yeah, but my problem's cocaine.
Well, you know what? When you love Jesus enough, the cocaine's not attractive anymore.
There you go. Worship disorder. And, Bill, I've been a licensed counselor for 20 years, at Hazelden, Salvation Army. You let me come out and talk to you guys 2 days a week. And I got to tell you, the preparation, the motivation, the three-month primary rehab, followed by the phase two, as I would call it, I have to bring my A game every time. Mm-hmm. It's a great community, and just what God has done, John, at Redemption House is truly incredible. And we're going to get this on the website for people. I strongly recommend this program. If you have an addiction problem yourself or somebody who in your family, the answer is Jesus. Because as John said, we're not looking at stopping the symptom. We need to look at the problem, and we need a new heart.
Amen.
And that can only come from the Lord. So this has been so enjoyable, Bill.
I love what John said about worshiping your way through addiction, and that is a great model for building up a discipline and a strength that you may have never had before. So, again, John, thanks so much for being a guest on the show. And, George, I have to say that wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Always great to see you. Always great to be back in the studio. And thanks to all of our listeners that listen to the show and share it with your friends. Go to myfaithradio.com if you want to get this podcast and pass it on to your friends. And have a great week. God bless, and talk to you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.